NASA 557, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say we've got three sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, Piston Power, and Avemco Insurance, a world-class provider of aviation insurance.
Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead. Well, hello, Todd.
Hello there, John.
We have another issue of our show today, and Greg had something come up and he couldn't join us. So we're going to talk about one of my favorite singers, Jim Croce, who died in a plane crash. Several of his songs were just made for motorcyclists, and in those years, I rode motorcycles, so I had a certain affection for him and his music, and it was unfortunate that we lost him so early. But why don't you hit us with the details, which there are not a lot of.
No, there aren't, and just to tease a later part of the show, we're also going to have a more up-to-date event. Happened last year with a Lufthansa, where one of the pilots passed out in the cockpit while the other pilot was out of the cockpit, but we'll get to that later. First, let's get back to Jim Croce's death, which was in September 20th of 1973. For those of you who have been hearing his music for the last 50-plus years, including myself, I used to hear his songs on American Top 40 back in the 70s. It seems like he's been around forever. His music has, but he unfortunately died at age 30. He had just entered into a phase of his career where he was getting a lot of traction, a lot of airplay. He had an album out shortly before this last album that he was promoting. It had the song Bad, Bad Leroy Brown on it, which, again, many of you probably know that as well. And he was touring 45 different dates to promote his new album, which has the song I Got a Name in it. And between two performances, one in Nacogdoches, Louisiana, and the second later on that night or following day in Sherman, Texas, about 210 nautical miles away, he, his bandmates, and several other people from the band and the pilot were all killed in a crash of a Beech 18, which is a twin-engine piston-driven aircraft. And those of you looking at the video version of this are seeing the version of the Beech that he was flying in. There are about 9,000 of these produced up until like 1969, 1970. But only 400 of them were of the more up-to-date version, the Beech E-18S, the type that he was flying in. A very popular aircraft for doing executive transportation. This is the Part 135 operation, by the way, a non-scheduled flight. Had a single pilot on board. And very common aircraft, very popular aircraft. In the accident itself, they're taking off late at night, just short of 11 o'clock, shortly after takeoff. The plane hit a tree off the end of the runway. Plane was destroyed. Everybody was killed. Now, there's not a whole lot to this accident investigation report. Now, those of you who are looking at the video version of this will see the entire report that the NTSB now has on its website. Less than a page, just a few pieces of data, the date, the weather, the hours of the pilot, and a cryptic remark on the bottom to the effect that the pilot had some sort of a heart condition, ran several miles to the airport before the airplane took off. No background data. And this is where I'm going to kick it over to you, John. I'm used to looking at NTSB reports that not only have a very detailed report, but also a very detailed public docket. There is no public docket here. And although it says in the bottom, full narrative is not available, at least in this report. Whatever fuller narrative existed doesn't exist anymore. And tell us why that is. That's so.
Well, basically, in those early years, all those records were kept by the investigator. If he happened to be an investigator that worked in D.C. office, then those records were available in D.C. Many of the investigators worked in the field, and those records either resided in the field office or more likely resided at home. Investigators were allowed to work at home for a long time. So they would be working at home half a day on an investigation, and maybe the other half of the day working on cases in backlog. For whatever the reason, a lot of that paperwork was kept at home, and it was never collected in D.C., especially for lower-level accidents like this. Not for an airliner, that's a different story. A GA crash, a 135 unscheduled charter at that time, was not held to very high standards, so it's not unusual for them to do that. And of course, there may not have even been an investigation at all. The way I read that report, it very well could have been just a bunch of facts given by the police officers on scene. You know, you find out who the officer was on scene, and you call him up afterwards, and you ask him a bunch of questions, and you make a very generic light-duty report. Because, you know, we still, to this day, don't investigate every single accident. What's a little bit different today is the FAA does investigate the ones that the NTSB doesn't, and it's more formal. So that Jim Croce report could have been the FAA guy who showed up there as well, not just the police. But in any event, it wasn't a very detailed report, and whatever facts they had were not kept in a central location.
And the facts that are there are scant at best. We know something about the pilot. He was actually an air transport pilot with quite a bit of time and type, 2190 hours in this particular aircraft model, 14,290 total. The aircraft itself, the Beech E-18S, was only produced starting in the 1950s. There were, like I said, over 9,000 of these produced during the lifetime of this aircraft. But these were a later version, bigger cabin, and reading between the lines is the kind of aircraft that was built more for executive transportation, very popular for this sort of thing. And there was nothing about this aircraft in the report, nothing in the sense of how many hours it had flown, when it was produced. I looked up on the FAA registry website. It goes so far back that there's nothing even about the registration of this. So again, I don't know who else had owned this. No record, no information on maintenance. But the thing that jumped out at me, we're talking about a situation where it's night. Visibility was 5 miles or more. There was some haze in the area, but it was VFR weather conditions. Yet this aircraft, after takeoff, hit a tree beyond the end of the runway. And there's no indication whether this was directly down the middle of the runway, whether it's to the left or to the right, nothing like that. And the photographs that I was able to find, there's a couple on the video version of this, these were taken by a university. There's a university co-located near this accident site, and someone from that university took several pictures of the wreckage, but doesn't really tell you anything about what the route of flight was, what the sequence of breakup event was, etc. So we're left to guess here. But the bottom line is this a tragic event? Famous only because of one of the people who was on board the aircraft. To this day, and we do accidents like this on a regular basis, you have situations where wealthy people, media people, entertainment stars are doing transportation. That's not airline transportation. They run a plane or they have their management company run a plane. And in some of the later accidents, like the ones we've talked about in the past, like Aaliyah, for instance, there's very clear evidence that there were some real shortcuts taken by the company that was renting this airplane. We have no idea if there are any shortcuts here. The only one that really, only piece of information that really jumps out at me repeatedly is the remarks at the end of the report. The pilot had severe coronary artery disease, ran from motel to near airport, about 3 miles. This is an airline transport pilot. If this person had severe coronary artery disease, why were they even given a medical certificate? I don't know what the rules were in the 1970s, but I believe now airline transport pilots have to get a medical examination every 6 months, and they have to pass whatever battery of tests they have. And I suspect, although I'm not sure, that if you have any kind of coronary artery disease today, you'd have to get a medical waiver to operate as an airline transport pilot. No information about that here. No idea if there is any kind of waiver for this person.
Well, the rules were different. That's almost 60 years ago. Rules were different. And like I said, I remember those years because I actually fueled a number of PH-18s. There were several of them on the field that I worked when I was going to school in the early 60s on the field. But my memory says they were ex-military airplanes, but that's, immaterial for this discussion. The fact is, it was a popular airplane. This guy had a lot of time in it. Something happened, whether it was his physical limitations. I would be very, very skeptical if he ran 3 miles. Sounds to me like either he overslept or was waiting in a motel for a ride to the airport, which didn't come in that particular location in Louisiana in the early 70s. I suspect that it's all farm country. There just was no ride available, and he had to make a choice. He had to get to the airplane. If he didn't own it, and he missed the flight, missed the time, there would be hell to pay. So he probably risked it and fast walked and jogged or whatever that 3 miles to get to the airport. And maybe, in fact, it did put a strain on his heart and resulted in a problem. Oh, we can't rule out an engine takeoff. I was hoping to look to see where if there was any diagrams or anything to show the location of that tree in relationship to the center line of the runway, which could have given us a clue of maybe a loss of engine on takeoff. But whatever was there years ago is long gone. So all we can say is that it's probably one of two or three things. It was, the first thing. Not knowing that, if I was the investigator, not knowing the history of the pilot, and I showed up at this airplane, it failed to get altitude on takeoff. Either he didn't have the speed or he lost control. How do you lose control on takeoff? Did he leave the gust lock on the airplane? Back in those days, the gust lock was wooden blocks that locked the tab on the elevator in place. Did he miss it? It was nighttime. He was obviously rushing that he ran to the airport. There's two ingredients leading up to a disaster right there. Three very obvious ones. His condition, loss of an engine on takeoff, and the gust lock still being installed.
And another possible issue is weight and balance. This aircraft was designed to hold about up to 11 passengers, and there were six people on board this aircraft. So if it were just passengers, not a problem. But these were passengers who were part of a band, and band has band equipment. There's no evidence here as to what kind of cargo was on this aircraft in addition to the passengers. And for that matter, if there was a weight and balance issue either on this flight or on previous flights. And without that information, it's hard to say what was going on. But one thing was clear. They had done a gig in that town, and they were doing a gig in another town. They had to get from one place to the other. They were leaving almost 11 o'clock at night. They would have been arriving into Sherman, Texas, which is just north of Dallas, very likely early in the morning. So it begs the question, after having a concert late at night, are the people packing this aircraft going to be taking the same care they would have if they were well rested? Just as with the pilot, would the pilot would have been taking the same level of care if he were not exhausted from running to the airport, as opposed to the situation we have here? Add to that, it's nighttime, so everything else that you usually do, whether as a passenger or as a pilot, is a little bit more difficult at night. So you add all these risk factors together, a little bit of haze. Happens to be a tree at the end of the runway. Who knows? They might have skirted disaster if there was no tree there and we'd never know about.
How true. How true. He certainly wouldn't self-report. Nobody did back in those days. It's unfortunate. But there's a tail to this story. And not just a tail I'm talking about like a tail on a dog. So interesting, when you look at the history of Jim Croce, and you had said it earlier, Todd, about it just breaking out. He had three albums that were successful. So he was just breaking out as an entertainer. And some of those songs were quite popular that he had on his album. And he perishes. He has a wife and a four-year-old son at the time. After his death, a stepfather enters the picture. So obviously the wife got remarried. The kid was subjected to some abusive treatment, apparently. The record's a little sketchy on that, but it's clear that there was something going on in the home, that he was struck in the head and went blind. He lost his vision. For the way it's written, it's tough to put a timeline on it, but it looks about 6 years. He had vision problems. And at some point towards the end of that period of time, he got some vision back in one eye. And during that period of time, the family supported themselves by marketing the songs that his father produced. So they had the revenue from the residuals, I guess, from the songs, and that supported the family. And then at some point when he was 15 or 16 years old, he started breaking out with his own music. He was playing instruments, mainly piano, all during that time. And I guess he was somewhat gifted with the piano. He finally broke out on his own and started doing songs of his own creation and covering some other songs that other people wrote. And then he started performing his own acts, his own album. So he's starting to climb in stature on his own, not in a legacy from his parent. So that's good news for him, and maybe good news for the rest of us that like that style of music. But it tells a terrible tale of somebody who was up and coming and getting killed by aviation and the system.
We're going to take a short break now to meet one of Avemco's employees from their Frederick, Maryland office.
Hi, my name is Marcy Veroni, and I'm in charge of training the underwriters that work here at Avemco. We have a Redbird simulator that we use in our training. It's a 172S model. Our local flight school also has 172s, so we hope that the non-pilots get the interest to go and then become pilots. But regardless, everybody that work here goes through ground school, either Sporties or King, and then we actually put them in the sim. We hire local CFIs to come in and take them through different scenarios. Then we take them to the airport. They've all watched an engine being torn down. They've all pre-flighted an airplane. Most of them have gone for a flight in an airplane. But the reason why I really like the sim is when there is a claim somewhere around the country, we're able to bring our team in here and fly the scenario and kind of teach them the mindset of the pilot and might have, you know, what went wrong, or is there anything from our point of view that we can help with the next caller that maybe wants to buy that airplane or do the scenario. So
when you're talking to an Avemco underwriter, you're getting somebody who really understands aviation. Even if they don't have a pilot certificate, they do understand aviation. You can tell them your story, you can give them your information, and they can do a fair and appropriate evaluation to issue you insurance.
Now, back to the flight safety detectives.
Now, I'm old enough to remember when this segment of business wasn't very good. They were flying DC-3s. In fact, I in my working career, I think I said it once on this podcast, in my working career, I actually worked for a window of time with a pilot who was on the Ricky Nelson airplane. And they all burned to death, and the assumption there was illegal drug activity in the back of the airplane, which caused a fire, and the airplane was lost. But he survived because he wore a Nomex suit. So he was, and he still did it when I met him. And everybody used to look at him like he was a little strange wearing that Nomex suit. But that saved his life, and I can understand why he would continue to wear one. You know, that's not material here. But the fact is that that segment of aviation was not stellar in performance, including some of the airplanes they use. I met some folks out in the western part of the United States that had several Vicomte airplanes. Now, those were DOT-powered four-engine airplanes. They charted very reasonably because nobody wanted them. A number of them crashed, and I remember Ray Charles had one of those. I actually ground-handled that airplane once later in my life when I was working for the airlines, and we shared a hangar with corporate airplanes, and when we had to move it to get our airplane out of it was in the way of our airplane. So, and that was one that was charted by Ray Charles. So there was a lot of entertainers that would fly 135. I always blame the managers on very little information, by the way, but I always blame the managers for not doing their due diligence on selecting the charter companies that they used. They probably based it on price. They probably received some consideration from the operators for bringing them work. The managers, because their whole method of getting paid is commissions off what they do. So that's not unusual in that line of work. So they would get consideration from the company that they hired for bringing them the work. And that may be a piece of why we had so much. Fast forward to today, or recent past, I know Greg and I both have done and continue to do evaluations of operations for high net worth people, whether they be entertainers or more likely businessmen that are climbing and haven't made it high enough yet to make enough money to get their own airplane and their own flight crews, but are flying around often. And we go in and evaluate who's flying for them. And there's a number of first class charter operations you can use. What we do now, since we've already vetted a number of them, is we will reference them as potential purchases. I mean, companies to make purchase from, and then we will actually recommend certain pilots. And these are the pilots that you want flying. You don't want a substitute unless they tell you, and then they can make a phone call to us, and we can do what we do to determine whether or not that's a good idea. And part of the reason for that is that both Greg and I, and for probably every investigator out there that's ever looked at a plane crash, has heard the stories from other pilots in those locations where the pilots that perished came from. And a common comment that I've heard more than once was, "I never would have flown with that guy. He's a risk taker, yada, yada, yada." And in fact, in the Bedford, Mass., Gulfstream 5 crash that killed some very wealthy people with a pilot who never did the checklist. He had a reputation of never doing the checklist. Out of 175 flights that they were able to document, and the number may be not 100% accurate, so out of a huge number of flights, they could only find a few that he did the checklist, ran the checklist on. And so I met two pilots in Bedford that told me that they would never fly with that guy because of that reason. So, I mean, that's opinion. You take it for what it's worth. As an investigator, what I took from that is do your homework. When I'm given a recommendation to somebody to go charter an airplane, I'm going to do my homework. I'm going to ask those questions around. Where does he live? What's his home airport that he flies out of? What's his opinion of the pilots in the airport? And use some of that to make my decision. If there's anybody out there that charters airplanes for entertainers or people, high wealth people, get somebody to do due diligence on the operation that you're going to contract with to make sure it's company worthy. I mean, Greg and I did some work with Greg did most of the work with somebody from NBC. NBC's airplanes were busy, and NBC just called somebody off a list that they had, and that airplane crashed and killed his kid. That was a tough one.
That was the Dick Ebersol accident.
Yes. Yes, in fact, occasionally his kid loved baseball and loved the Red Sox, so they had a field made right here in Boston in honor of the kid. And I go by there occasionally, and it was just recently, as a matter of fact, and I'm always reminded of that. If we just do our due diligence, we can avoid some of this. Those aren't accidents when you just willy-nilly go charter an airplane and get, oh, you know how to fly? Okay, come on. And you don't look at the background, you don't do the homework. I mean, you're just raising the risks exponentially. Take a minute, do some homework, make some phone calls.
Now, I'd like to switch gears and go back to the event that we actually teased earlier in the show. Early last year, February of 2024, there was a Lufthansa A321 going from Frankfurt to Seville, Spain, where during the flight, the captain left the cockpit for whatever reason, which is allowed. The European regulations and the airline regulations allow one of the pilots to leave the cockpit for what they call physiological reasons. Let's say go to the bathroom. While the pilot, the captain, was gone, the first officer had some sort of a medical event and passed out. And the captain wasn't able to get back into the cockpit. Apparently, whatever code he was using, he was having trouble opening the door. Fortunately, the first officer did come to and opened the door from the inside, and they were able to divert to Madrid. But this raised a whole bunch of issues, and you don't have to be an expert to realize what some of those issues are. One of them being, you can really have one person in the cockpit flying an airliner? According to the European regulations, yes. And in our research, albeit brief, we couldn't find a definitive regulation in the FAA about that. Different airlines do things differently. One of the processes is if a captain or first officer leaves the cockpit, someone else is in the cockpit, so you have two people in the cockpit at all times. Could be a flight attendant, could be a deadheading pilot, could be whomever. Someone who's authorized to be in the cockpit, rather. But in this case, this was a close call. Had that first officer not woken up, had the captain or the flight attendants not had the correct emergency code, or if the lock were broken, you could have had a situation where it was impossible to get into the cockpit and there's no one flying the airplane. As it was, this was a situation where the first officer was passed out for about 10 minutes. So during that 10-minute time, fortunately during cruise, there was nobody there answering air traffic control calls, no one there to do an evasive maneuver if there is a TCAS alert. This was a serious situation. Very detailed report, unlike the first one we talked about earlier today, which you're going to be able to download if you go to the webpage supporting this episode. And at the end of it, the recommendation was, well, we should tell airlines this so they can reconsider what their policies are. Well, in my opinion, that's not good enough. And I think, John, you agree with my opinion.
Oh, where's their memory for German wings? When the captain stuck out and the first officer who was having mental issues nosedived the airplane. Would a flight attendant in the cockpit be able to stop that? Probably not. But at least you could open the door and let the other captain come back in. It's crazy. And I think the U.S. rule, of company rules, require a flight attendant who's been trained to come in, even if there's a deadheading pilot on board. Because my recollection is that it's only one time, but my recollection is that I, sitting in first class, when they did that transfer, because the captain had to come out and use the facilities, there was a deadheading person in the cockpit, and the flight attendant went in anyway. So it may be in the rule that, and it could be a TSA rule, that's what has to happen. I don't know. I've never focused on a rule. I've just been told it's been a rule. So we will follow that one up to get our facts right on why we do that and what's the background for it. Mm-hmm. But this thing with the foreign, a German carrier, you know, Lufthansa of all, to have one person in the cockpit is just staggering. Now, I will say that in Europe, there is a tremendous amount of pressure on the manufacturers, Airbus in particular, to build their airplane certified for one person crew. that the Europeans in particular do not want to be paying for two pilots. They want to be able to fly these airplanes with single pilot. And manufacturers are going to respond to their customers' demands, essentially. And I know, I've been told, Airbus is working on a single pilot version of their airplanes. I don't know who they're going to fly, but it's not going to be me.
You mentioned Germanwings earlier. For those of you who are aviation fans, know that Germanwings is a division of Lufthansa. And here it is, Lufthansa, the parent company, had an event with a single pilot where the airplane was lost, yet they didn't have any major changes in policy, which flashes me back to FedEx. Back in, I think, the early 1990s, there was a case where a deadheading FedEx pilot tried to commandeer a DC-10 and take out the pilots and crash the airplane and collect a lot of insurance. Fortunately, they were able to suppress that and land the airplane. But a couple of years after that, I remember going to an air show up in Canada, and I talked to a FedEx crew. I asked them, hey, you know, after this thing happened in your company, was there any change in policy with respect to having FedEx employees sort of like riding in as passengers in your cargo airplane? I said, no, we had no change in policy. So this is an organizational thing. If you have a policy, personnel policy, which works most of the time, and you have an aberration like this, are you going to change the policy, even though common sense might scream at you to change that policy? Well, in these two airline cases, no.
You know, just yesterday, I had a pilot from a major cargo carrier that operates both domestically and internationally. He mentioned that they have three seats for passengers in their airplane, but they're in the last row. Back at the bulkhead, they sit in the back of the airplane. Since most of those airplanes are loaded with igloos, looks like the little house you see on there, like sheds in the back people of your yard, those things are packed so tightly that you couldn't easily come from the back of the airplane to the front of the airplane. So maybe that's part of what that particular outfit has done, is to move the possibility of a problem to the back of the airplane. And anybody with knowledge of the airplane could still cause problems in the back of the airplane. I don't know. I guess they have enough latitude to do whatever they want in that area. You know, the cockpit door, do they have the same secure cockpit door? I don't know the answer to that. It's going to be interesting.
We've discussed two very different events here today, one from 50 years ago, one from just over a year ago. Both of them have opportunities for education and understanding. In the first case, by the way, this is my second to last word. In the first case, you know, we had some understanding of the historical record of the NTSB. It's very hard to get detailed insights off of something that happened 50 years ago because the system just wasn't in place to record that. Fast forward to last year, you have a very detailed report about an incident that didn't result in any injuries, didn't result in any deaths, didn't result in any aircraft damage. But it is giving us food for thought about current policies when it comes to people in the cockpit. So the second to last word is, you can learn from the old, you can learn from the new, but the key thing is to learn and ask questions.
And aviation is nothing but a learning adventure. You know, and a lot of people don't look at it that way. Greg and I were fortunate the last 2 days. We had, I didn't count, 50 or 60 people very interested in aviation safety. We had their undivided attention for 2 days. With all the accidents that we presented and the facts and the learning moments. And they were very focused in it. It was pilots, flight attendants, mechanics, and company management people that were in this group that we had. So it was sort of heartwarming or encouraging for somebody like me to realize that there are a lot of good people still out there coming up within the ranks of the aviation community that are really, really interested in maintaining a safe operation. So that was really good. But for all you pilots out there flying general aviation, I'll give you the same education I give you every single week with this show. If you're going to go flying, do a good session of pre-planning. Do one before you get to the airport. Do it again at the airport. And if it doesn't agree, find out why. When you get out to the airplane, do a good pre-flight. We spent a lot of time in the last 2 days with these pilots talking about pre-flights, and had a number of them come up to me and say that they realize now that they needed to change the way they accomplish their pre-flight. And when you get in the airplane, finish it in the cockpit check. And when you get off the ground, put your head on a swivel. There's just so damn much traffic out there, and a lot of it is these new pilots that are trying to build time. And, you know, when you're new, you're going to make mistakes. When you're old, you make mistakes. So don't get wrapped up in somebody else's mistake. Be alert enough to see what's coming and get out of the way. And please, please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetothetexas@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
Avemco Insurance Company has thousands of 5-star reviews on Trustpilot.com. Here's one from Henry K., who said, "For more than 18 years, Avemco has insured me and my aircraft. The cost has been very reasonable, and the service excellent. Completely satisfied. The only claim I ever had was handled quickly and to my complete satisfaction. Avemco is a first-rate insurer." Experience the advantage going direct with Avemco Insurance Company. Call 888-879-0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. And don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for 5% off your premium.